campaign advocating for Wayne Gretzky as the greatest Canadian. From Edmonton, I'm joined on the line by Deborah Gray. When she won a by-election in 1989, she made history by becoming the first ever Reform Party Member of Parliament representing Beaver River in Alberta. Three more elections and 15 years later, she left active political life, the Member of Parliament for Edmonton North. A Reform Party stalwart, her membership number was 002, she was also instrumental in the founding of both the Canadian Alliance and the Conservative Parties of Canada. As well, she is remembered as one of the House of Commons' more colorful and tenacious members. Never retreat, never explain, never apologize, My Life, My Politics is the title of her new book, $29.95 Canadian, published by Key Porter Books. Please welcome to thecommentary.ca, Deborah Gray. Good afternoon, Ms. Gray.
Yes, hello there.
The greatest Canadian, I want to ask you about that. How did you get involved with that?
I had CBC phone my office on Parliament Hill early this spring before I left office and asked if I wanted to host a one-hour show, and I said, oh, sure, that'd be just fine, having no idea really what the project was or what it was all about. So it was very fun when I started to hear more details about it. They may not be the 10 people that I chose, they may not be the top 10 for you, but you know what? It got Canadians talking, and that's what the project was all about. So I think it was absolutely terrific. So as I learned more about it and did not get to choose who I would be advocating for, although I really do think Wayne Gretzky is terrific. I'm a big Oilers fan and a big hockey fan, so it was just a perfect match. I loved it.
Now, you live in Edmonton now.
I do.
But you were born in Vancouver, right?
Born and raised right in Vancouver in Kerrisdale. I went to Prince of Wales High School, graduated there in 1970, and then moved up to Alberta after a couple of years of university, and I have been living here most of my adult life.
You were born on the 1st of July, right?
Born on the 1st of July at the Grace Hospital.
You pick the day, I guess?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool day for the kind of work I ended up in, that's for sure. But I have three older sisters, and boy, I'll tell you, their birthdays were just boring. I said, what's the matter, you know? You don't have any fun stuff going on your birthday like I do.
Right.
And that's just the way it was. I was blessed to be born on that day. And then when I was a member of Parliament, actually the first job I ever had in my life where I had to really work on my birthday. So, but it's a great day, and I mean, it's all Canadian, that's for sure.
Yeah. I've read a lot of books this fall. A ton of books, really. out of all the books that I've read, I probably consider yours probably the most refreshing. Was that difficult, a task to write, or was it cathartic, or was it easy?
No, I enjoyed the whole process. I am an English teacher by trade, so, you know, I do enjoy writing, and it was cathartic to some degree, except, you know, I keep pretty short accounts and never let things go on and fester, so there were some difficult times in our life, you know, with an alcoholic father, and he's sober now. I'm grateful for that, but, you know, our whole growing up here's It was very, very difficult. So that was good to get it on paper. And this is not one of those tell-all books where, you know, I spill my guts about everything. You know, I think you could probably agree to that because you've read it, so
right.
You know that. But it also is a real story to tell. I mean, you know, with my exit from Parliament is the end of an era, the reform era. And so I think this was important to get this story down. Because, you know, the Conservative Party's all back together and doing well, et cetera, et cetera. But it really is no longer the reform era. So I think it was good to do that. And I am a storyteller. And I love people. And so I think that really shows through in a lot of the work in the book, that this is just it's a narrative by a regular old Canadian who ended up in a pretty, I say remarkable, but ridiculously remarkable part of the country in the House of Commons making Canadian history, because I really, you know, was nothing spectacular, and it's just the way it ended up, and I think serves as a real inspiration to people to say, if you have a passion to do something, do it. I'll tell you, there's just nothing like it, and you don't want to regret saying, you know, I wish I had done such and such. So I think that there's real lessons for people in there to say, I want to do this, I have a passion to do something, so I could just do it. The actual title of the book is from Nellie McClung, one of the famous five who was instrumental in the Persons case in 1929, and the whole quote is, never retreat, never explain, never apologize, just get the thing done and let them howl. And that's pretty well the way I've lived my life, and comes through pretty clearly, I think, in the book.
Right. Now, you mentioned your father, Mansell, and you talked about the alcoholism. How is he doing? You said he was sober?
Yeah, he's sober now. He's been sober for several years, and we are just so glad about that, because he missed so much. of good stuff that was going on when his kids were growing up, and you know, he regrets that a great deal. And it's just amazing to see somebody truly deal with a major addiction, and it's just so good to know that you know, he kind of missed some of the kids and grandkids growing up, but he has great grandchildren now, and it's just marvelous to see that so much of that time has been redeemed, truly.
Page 22 of your book, you write, "I will never totally trust this man again." You were on vacation, I believe, and he threw you in the lake. Was that?
Yeah, said, "You might as well learn how to swim now," and tossed me into the water. I was terrified. I was about 6 or 7 years old, and you know, I'll never forget that feeling of just absolute terror and panic that gripped me. My sisters were there and kind of witnessed this whole thing, but they couldn't get to me fast enough. And I do remember saying so clearly in my little tiny mind, you know, I was just a young girl, saying, "I will never trust him completely again." And those were the drinking days. And again, you know, I'm able to say that he is sober, and I'm so grateful for that, and have been able to, you know, put that trust back in him, to say that, you know, he had a very serious illness at the time of alcoholism, and it's good to see that, you know, those days are truly behind him. It's wonderful.
Do you think that affected your life? I assume that affected your life. That...
Oh, yeah, it can't help but affect your life. I mean, these are, you know, when children watch this kind of stuff going on, you, in your very young mind, you formulate opinions and ideas about things. And I remember one of the major life decisions I made was that I am never, ever going to drink. And you think, how could a six-year-old kid make that decision and make it stick? You know, because you think six-year-old kids, I mean, they, you know, they play and they horse around and they think about things, but probably not terribly seriously. And I'm 52 years old now. I have never, ever had a drink in my life. And I'm grateful for that in many respects, because, you know, the life that I ended up in Parliament, you could just imagine, because you've seen too many people, you know, literally crash and burn on the rocks because of alcohol abuse. And yet at the same time, then I laugh and say to people, you know, I get into enough trouble dead sober, so it's a really good thing that I'm not a drinker. And so for lots of reasons, I'm really grateful that I never have had a drink.
But you stole a Bible from a church once when you were a young girl, right?
I was 13 years old, going to Camp Homewood over on Vancouver Island, and I had my little list of things that I was supposed to take along to camp. Okay, sleeping bag, check. You know, flashlight,
right.
Check. That would be just fine. Bible, and I thought, ooh, I can't check that. I don't have a Bible. So I thought, well, you know, where do you get a Bible? You go to the church, and that made perfect sense to me. I'm always practical, and so I rode my bicycle up to the church at St. Mary's Anglican Church at 37th and Large,
right.
And went in. The church was open. I went in, and there were just piles of Bibles there, so I thought, well, I'll just take that. So I took it, and then went back home and went to my little camp list and thought, okay, Bible, check, got that, and there it was.
Now, was that the camp where you met Elaine Strom?
Yes.
And,
yes,
and
it's on Quadra Island, right close to, just across the water from Campbell River.
And she taught you, well, she told you what it meant to be a Christian, and I guess that had a terribly influential part on your life and your early thinking, was it not?
Yes, it was. You know, as a teenager that was, I mean, every teenager seems as in lots of pain about lots of areas of their life, and it's a very difficult time. I also had the added, you know, influence of being, I think, probably the only family in our school at Prince of Wales High School that, you know, was in serious trouble. Probably lots of them were in trouble, but nobody ever talked about it back then. And so I was really hurting from that. I missed my dad desperately. You know, he was drinking. We didn't know where he was. We didn't hear from him, you know, for months and on end. And so, you know, that was a very, very difficult time in my life. But when my counselor at camp, Elaine Strom, told me what it was like to be a Christian, that this was a, you know, a good thing to do, and your life could be truly satisfied and happy, I thought, wow, she really believes this stuff that she's talking about. And so in 1966, when I came home from camp, again with my stolen Bible, this was the next summer now, a whole year later, and I read it, and I thought, that's right, God really loves me for who I am. not because I was the troublemaker or the mischief person at my school, or, you know, I mean, people think that I just got sassy when I went to Parliament. No, I mean, I've always been like this. This has been my life. And so I thought, wow, God really does love me. And so I remember kneeling down saying, okay, Lord, I don't know who you are, I don't know what you are, but I'm going to take a chance on this, and I want my life to have more meaning, more purpose, and I really was looking for forgiveness for, you know, a very difficult and painful life up to that point. So I thought, wow, that's it. And then when I had done that, I went back to the church. I thought, okay, this Bible is stolen, and this is not a good thing to do. So I went back to the church on my bicycle, and I told them the story. I said, I'm a Christian now, and this Bible belongs to you. It's helped me a great deal, but it's really yours, so I'm giving it back to you now. And I then had my own Bible now that I had bought myself, and they just thought that was an unbelievable story. And so they got their Bible back, and my life turned around, and here I am, you know, this many years later. So it was a great story. I think they thought it was pretty wild, and I was some crazy young teenager, and there I was. But it really turned my life around.
Now, you're deeply religious. On the back of the book, Preston Manning calls you a winsome Christian. But you never wore your religion on your sleeve as like other people in your party.
Yeah, I think it's important to show your faith, not just tell it all the time. Like, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, yes, I'm this, I'm that. But if you don't live that, then what's the point? You know, people aren't going to pay much attention to it. So I always felt it was more important and way more practical for me to live my faith out so that people might see that rather than just hear me yattering away about it, and maybe my life and my words wouldn't add up and meet each other somewhere in the middle. So I think that's very important for people of faith, not just my faith as a Christian, but for people of faith in general. That's so important to live it and not just talk about it all the time. They have to meet and marry in the middle.
Page 221 of your book, you talk about you write that many people believe that if having a Christian in a position of influence or power is automatically a good thing, and you write, this is nonsense. This is dangerous. There's a lot of talk about the separation of church and state in the United States, especially with the re-election of the president. Do you think that the separation of church and state, is that something that we'll have to deal with in the coming years in this country?
Oh, I think so, because so many people, they talk about it, and yet it really does need to be real. It really does need to make a difference. And so when I talk about the separation of church and state, it seems to me that the state should not become involved in affairs of the church as such. I think it's essential for Christian people or people of faith to get involved in the political arena, but not the church as an institution. Because the church as an institution has a mission, and that is to proselytize, that is to spread the gospel, that is to do things that, you know, the church is supposed to do. If they get politically involved, and they are wrong, for instance, on some issue, what in the world happens then? You know, it calls into question their central message. And so that's the fuss I have, and the thing where I think so many people in the church, per se, are wrong, that they may get involved as individuals, that's important. But as soon as the whole church steps in and makes that their sense of mission, boy, I tell you, if they get out on a limb somewhere and they are, you know, wrong on an issue, then why should anyone believe anything they say?
We're talking with the former Member of Parliament and the former leader of Her Majesty's Loyal Official Opposition, Deborah Gray, whose new book is Never Retreat, Never Explain, Never Apologize, $29.95 Canadian, published by Key Porter. The Frog Lake Reserve, that's a Cree reserve, is it?
Yes.
And that's where you began your teaching career, right?
I began my teaching career, yes, at Frog Lake Reserve. It was it's about 3 hours north, but mostly east of Edmonton, up close to the Saskatchewan border. I'm a high school English teacher by trade, but I got a job offer teaching grade 4. And I'd been to university and Bible school for a very long time, and I just thought, yay, a job, I'll take it. Mm-hmm. And they said, this is teaching grade 4. And I thought, oh dear, I'm a high school teacher. But I remember thinking, oh well, any idiot can teach grade 4. That was fine. And boy, did I find out when I got out to the reserve. It was April the 25th, I think. Finished my last exam April the 24th and drove out to the reserve and found myself in a classroom with a bunch of kids who had 3 teachers already that year. I was number 4, and it's spring, So what does that tell you? You know, these kids are thinking, oh, yay, you know, we'll have fun with her for the rest of the school year. And not half of them, but several of the kids in the class had not learned to read yet. So I thought, oh, man, what do I do? Because I was a high school teacher. I do not know how to teach people to read. And I say, God bless all the teachers in the world who know how to teach kids how to read. To me, this is nothing short of a true miracle. But it wasn't me. I didn't know how to do it. So I remembered thinking, oh, man, I've bitten off more than I can chew here. I am in deep trouble. But it seems to me that what teachers need to do is not just teach, but know how to learn. And that was the big lesson I learned out of that, because I said to the kids, you know, what can I learn from you? Because it was clear I didn't know how to teach them how to read. So I thought, man, I've got to learn here. They took me down to the creek. It was springtime. And those kids taught me how to fish with my bare hands, something that I had never seen done before, something that I didn't think I would ever be able to do. And by that learning experience and me making myself vulnerable to those kids and having them being able to teach me something, they really did pay more attention to their mathematics, you know, times tables and everything else after that. Why? Because I had made myself vulnerable to them, and they were able to teach me something. And that was just an amazing, amazing experience in my life. And I'll never forget that feeling of getting my bare hands in there in a freezing cold creek with my pant legs rolled up. And those kids taught me how to fish with my bare hands. And when I threw that fish up on the shore, oh, man, I'll tell you, we all just went crazy. It was really exciting.
And then you went to you moved on to Dewberry High. Is that a high school? Or is that an elementary school?
Well, it's a small town, and so they had school grades, kindergarten to grade 12.
I see.
In the same school, but I taught junior high and senior high English. So that was my area of expertise, and really enjoyed it, but became part of community there. And that was a very small school, small town. And so I would see my kids, my students' parents, over at the bank. They worked at the co-op, they worked in the gas station, and I really was part of community there. It was a great experience.
And then is that what led you into foster care, going into foster care?
Yes, I had a stable lifestyle. I was teaching school, and I saw in the newspaper one day that they needed foster parents. And I thought, boy, you know, I could do that. I was a teacher and had my own home, and I applied and said, you know, if you're having a crisis, if there's problems, if anybody needs help, I could open my home to that, to any kids, but they have to be school age, obviously. I went to school every day, so I thought that would be a pretty important stipulation. And months went by, and I hadn't heard anything from them. In fact, just about forgot about the whole thing, and then got a phone call in April of 1984, saying, we have two kids here, and we need a foster home for them. It's a, you know, a desperate situation. We really need help. Can you help us out? And I thought, two kids? And I thought, man, oh, man, that was maybe more, you know, than I could handle, too. But I said, well, you know, when would this be? And they said, today, after school. I said, today? I don't know if I could do that so fast. But anyway, it was a boy and a girl. So I said, could I have 24 hours anyway? And they said, sure. So I raced home after school and got two bedrooms ready for a boy and a girl, and that just literally changed my life upside down. I became a parent overnight to a brother and a sister who, you know, just worked their way right into my life and into my heart, and just an amazing experience. I had six or seven foster kids over the span of the next several years then, and what an opportunity that was. You go into it knowing that the kids are going to be leaving and you're going to lose them. So you have to make the decision early on. Am I willing to do this when I know that it's going to rip my heart out down the road? And I made that decision to do it, and I just wept, you know, big tears every time the kids left. But I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Now, those first two kids, the brother and the sister, that was Andrea and Teddy, right?
Yes, those are names I used for them in the book.
Do you still hear from them?
I haven't heard from them for a while. When I was still out in my Beaver River riding, they would stop into my constituency office in St. Paul. I have not seen those kids for a while, and one or two of the kids, one of them for sure that I know of, was killed in a dreadful car accident where alcohol was involved. Another one moved back with his mother down to Montana in the States, so they're not around anymore. And another one just kind of disappeared from sight totally, so I don't think that anybody's had any contact with her. And boy, that just hurts too, because you want to be involved, you want to carry on, but it hasn't been possible for most of the cases.
Now, you were teaching at Dewberry, the Dewberry School, and then your friend Liz White, who is who was then a Reform Party member, dared you to run in the election of 88, right?
Yep, the Reform Party was brand new. I was not politically active at all. I'm a proud and passionate Canadian, paid attention to what went on. But at the same time, I thought, they're all the same. And, you know, didn't have much time or energy for any political party or any person. And then she said, this brand new Reform Party, we don't have a candidate yet here. They carved out a new riding because of redistribution. And she said, Deb, why don't you run for us? And I said, oh, Liz, come on. You know, I'm a teacher. And it was September 88 at that point. I was back at school. I was busy. I didn't have any foster kids in care that year. I had three teenage daughters the year before. And they had all left for various reasons at that time. And then Liz said, I dare you to run for this brand new party. And I thought, that dare just, it was just, I can't ever give up a good dare. And so I ended up being nominated for the party and ran the first time Reform put out candidates. It was a great experience. But I came fourth. I came a very distant fourth. And then 5 days later, the candidate who had won that, the PC, he had won basically on free trade. And died 5 days later of cancer, and so we were thrown into a by-election situation. And way leads on to way, as Robert Frost said, in a road not taken. And I found myself thinking, you know, Preston Manning could come in here and just, you know, this would be great, and he could run. And he asked me if I would consider running, because he said he had traveled all over the length and breadth of the Beaver River riding and said, what do you think about this candidate? And they said, well, we wanted free trade, but we'd sure be willing to give her a try in the by-election situation. So there it is, and as you know, the rest is history.
But you never met, because page 82 I couldn't understand, you never met Preston Manning until the by-election?
Yeah, I had heard him speak once, but I had never met him.
You describe him as an unpolitical politician. How is that possible?
That's possible because he was not obsessed with power, and he just wanted to see some reforms brought in, and just had no ego whatsoever. Just he had grown up in the halls of the legislature in Alberta as a kid because his father was the premier of Alberta, and he was not consumed by power. He just truly had a sense of mission that this was what needed to be done in the country. And when I met him, I thought, man, he is amazing. He asked if I would run again in the by-election. Most politicians would be right in there with their elbows sharp and saying, thanks a lot for the warm-up show, now step out of the way, you know, I'm here. But he didn't do that. And I remembered being, you know, just absolutely amazed by this guy and ended up running in the by-election and made Canadian history. And nobody was more excited that night than Preston himself. He got his father, Ernest Manning, on the phone. It was springtime. His parents were still down in Arizona. They wintered down there. And Preston, he was just as excited as anybody in the room. You know, a lot of people that have ego problems would say, oh, that's really nice, but now she's going to get the limelight and I'm not. It was amazing. He was as excited as anything and said, my dad's on the phone and wants to talk to you. And he was just absolutely thrilled. And we operated as a really good team over the next few years while I was the only reformer there, because he was not obsessed by ego, and he was as excited with any accomplishments that we had as if it had been he himself in Parliament.
When Robert Stanfield died, people considered him the greatest Prime Minister that we never had. Will we think of Preston Manning in the same light, especially in these last...
I think so. As the party moved on in lots of ways, a lot of people said that, boy, Preston was amazing, and they wanted a new leader. They thought Preston had taken us as far as we could go. And then you saw what happened down the years with Stockwell coming in as leader, and he provided a function for the party, that's for sure, but it did not last very long, and there were 40-some of the 50-some members left in the caucus after that dreadful summer in 2001. That were prepared to sign a motion of non-confidence. And that was a very difficult time for all of us, Stockwell included. But, we needed to move on with leadership, and I think Stephen Harper's done an amazing job for the party and just came very, very close to winning this last election in June this year, and I think that he is maturing, and I think that he has a tremendous opportunity to be the next Prime Minister of the country. But Preston was a visionary that, of course, Stephen worked with when Stephen was very young as well.
And Stephen Harper was your legislative assistant when you first hit the Commons, right?
I was his boss. He was he was my legislative assistant because he was our party's policy officer, and just very bright, very capable. And so when I first went down to Parliament, Preston Horn. hornswoggled him into becoming my first legislative assistant because I knew absolutely nothing. And Harper had been down on Parliament Hill working for the Tories some years before that. And so he came down and spent my first year down with me there and gave me just a tremendous background and real solid support for my first year there.
I remember reading Preston Manning's book, and he alluded to this a little bit, and you mentioned this as well in your book in passing, this coolness between Stephen Harper and Preston Manning. What was that about?
I don't know all the details. You'd have to talk to Stephen himself, I think, but I think maybe he wanted the party to go in another direction than Preston did. He may not have agreed with Preston on all kinds of things, and I mean, that's okay, too, because, you know, I don't agree with my husband on 100% of issues. You might find that shocking, I know, but
right.
That I, you know, would have some opinions of my own. But Preston and Stephen obviously had some issues that they needed to work out, but I think Stephen moved on to another life, and that's what happened, and yet learned a lot from Preston and has given Preston all kinds of respect and accolades because, you know, let's face it, Preston got us to, you know, where we are today, and Stephen was able to build on that, and I think that's terrific. He gives Preston full marks for that.
You alluded to the leadership of Stockwell Day. That was a difficult time, was it not, for you personally?
It was a difficult time for all of us, for sure. And Stockwell went from being a big fish in a small pond of provincial politics to federal politics, and maybe kind of one leap too fast. But what happened was I was not able to cover in lots of ways because I had a reputation of being a straight shooter and straightforward with the press. And I saw some things happening that I just wasn't able to support Stockwell on. I had a pretty strong track record of saying we're having a family discussion, we're keeping it at the family table. But when I had a confidential discussion with Stockwell, just saying I was going to step back as his deputy leader on the 23rd of April in 2001, and saying we'll keep this confidential and then we'll have a discussion about it in caucus on Wednesday, 2 days hence. 45 minutes later, the National Press Gallery was told about it. They were phoned and told, and then the whole thing flew loose, and it should never, ever have been made public because these are the kinds of family discussions that, as if, you know, if I were, same thing, if I were having a disagreement with my husband, you will never know about it because, you know, it doesn't affect you, and these are the things that we'll work through on our own. Unfortunately, they phoned the press, and the whole thing flew loose. It was very difficult for everybody. But as I say, I was blamed almost single-handedly for that, and that's unfortunate. I had worked so many years to see this thing come to fruition and to see it all just piddled away. I just couldn't do that. But anyway, when it was private and then made terribly, terribly public, that was unfortunate. But as I say, of the remaining 50-some people in the caucus that summer, 42 of them, I believe, were signing a motion of non-confidence. So it happened for the best. It was difficult. It was painful. But I always say I don't mind pain as long as there's growth attached to it. And we were able to grow and move beyond that. And Stockwell is a member of Parliament even yet in the party. So, you know, that's good. Everybody's moved on from that. And I think Harper also has been able to not just put the caucus back together after that difficult summer, but to get together with the Conservatives, and whoever thought that was going to happen anytime soon. So I think he's showing leadership with that, and I give everybody in the party kudos, and everybody's moving ahead and doing really well.
The Grassroots for Day lawsuit against you, what was that about, and is that what's the current status of that? Is that finished?
Well, it's over, thank goodness. It took far too long, and they dropped their lawsuit but ended up having to pay expenses for it because it was spurious.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was I made a comment Newsworld, on Don Newman, CBC Newsworld, just saying that if the Grassroots for Day people were making spurious allegations, that's crazy. And so I said, if that's what they're doing, that would be very unwise because the party should be working together and fighting the same cause. So they accused me of defamation of character and sued me for $500,000. I've been involved in the political arena, as you know, for a very long time and had never been sued before by anybody. And then my own party guys did it. And they set up a group called Grassroots for Day. And, it's a long, tedious story. But anyway, they really had no grounds. So they ended up dropping their case because I decided that if this group, Grassroots for Day, whoever they were, if they won their case, and I didn't think they had a chance of it, but if in fact they won their case, I would be duty bound to pay them. So I wanted to know who they all were, and I asked for the names on the list of who the members were. Conversely, if I won my case, they would all owe X percent of my legal bills, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I wanted to know who they were, so we ended up asking names and addresses of all who all the members of Grassroots for Day were. Turned out they had three members. So it was, you know, unfortunate, because the thing just got way too much airtime and way too much fuss made about it. And they ended up having to pay the cost. So that was just a difficult time for everybody, but just a, you know, complete waste of time and energy when we should have been getting ready to fight the election. But I won that lawsuit, and do I take any pleasure in that? None. You know, it should have never happened in the first place. But anyway, it's all over and done with and passed, and as I say, we've all moved on, so that's good.
Now you discussed the opting in back to the pension. Joe Clark called you the high priestess of hypocrisy.
Yeah, that
for
was
doing
actually
that.
A pretty funny line that old Joe came up with. You know,
one of the rare ones, I suppose.
That's a good thing. Well, the part that Joe didn't mention on that was that the government legislated us back into the pension plan. We opted out of it in the year 1995, saying that the pension plan was too rich. I did not agree with opting out. We did not follow our party policy on that. What happened was we had made some substantive changes in the pension plan, and we should have declared victory on that. But what happened was some of the members decided that, you know, we should go farther and we should opt out of the plan altogether and have no pension. That was never our intention, to have no pension. You know, people put in long years. They work at places. You know, they pay into pension plans. I think they deserve pensions. But we had really made some substantive changes to the MP pension. The government was putting in $6 to one employer-employee contributions, and we got that change down to $3. And 41 cents, I think, to every dollar that the MPs put in. So we should have claimed victory. What happened was it got emotional, and it was political, trying to make hay, and saying that, you know, this is great, we'll all opt out of the plan. I went along with the crowd, and because I was the poster girl for it, I was already vested. You see, I'd put my 6 years in. So we all opted out and made a big fuss of it, and did that more for political reasons than anything else, I'm sad to say. And so what happened was, we ended up opting out. The government put us all back in 2000. So it wasn't a matter of opting in. We were all legislated back in because all of our members were members of the plan after the class of 93 that were in. So they had to be in the plan. The government put us all back in the plan, and what Joe was talking about, what we took the flak over, was that we had to decide whether to buy back our years of service. And I had served 12 and a half years at that point. It had no teacher's pension because I did not teach a full 10 years. I taught some of the time with the Public Servants Alliance of Canada, and they gave me my contributions back. So in the Alberta teacher's pension, I only have 8.5 years, I think. So what happened was we had to decide whether we would buy back our years of service. And we did that, except for Preston and Werner Schmidt. And I put in my book, those are the only two I knew about. Since then, Lee Morrison, who was an MP from southern Saskatchewan, said that he also did not buy back into the service, the pension plan. I think he had a pension from someplace else. Not sure about that. But anyway, we bought it back, and my pension to buy back into was $90,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it didn't come freebie by any means. And I bought back that service, as did my other colleagues. But, you know, again, we took a terrible lot of heat on it. And you know, Joe had a point there that, you know, it looked like we went back on our word, but we should have never made such a fuss about it in the first place. And also, we, you know, we did not buy back into it free, that's for sure.
Do you miss the daily grind of political life? Do you miss being an MP?
Not one bit. And a lot of people say politics is addictive. You know, you'll never be able to stand a deb on the outside. You know, you'll want to be back in there. And then since it's a minority government, a lot of people say, oh, good, Deb, you know, you could just get back into it just really soon because, you know, an election will be soon. I chose my time to leave. I chose the time to let go of a trapeze and move on to something new. And so I think when you close the door yourself, you do it as graciously as you can. You know, I gave up a salary of $140,000 a year, and there's times I just think, why did I do that? You know, it was safe. It was, you know, all these things. But I don't want to live just to be safe. I have a wonderful poster that says, a ship in a harbor is safe. But that's not what ships are built for. I'm 52 years old. You know, I still have lots of things I can do. I still have lots of passions. And when I chose my time to leave, I have not missed it one bit because I knew that chapter was finished and I can now go on to something else. I'm still not sure what it is. It's terrifying, and I feel like I'm in free fall still. It's terrifying, but it's exhilarating at the same time because there's still always new challenges out there.
Now, you work for this outfit called the Parliamentary Group. What exactly do you do there?
We have formed a government relations firm, helping people with the maze and the labyrinth of government. If they need help with legislation, they need help getting legislation through or whatever. This is not just a lobby group that goes to government saying, you know, we need more money. This is to help people who have great ideas and they don't know how to push them ahead. They don't know how to work them through. And so you have to be a former member of parliament to be part of this group because we have all been there. We've all seen it. We've all been members of parliament on the other side of the fence, listening to people coming and making presentations to us. So we've seen it, we've been there, and we can help people work their way through this labyrinth of government. So there's that. I'm also working with a group called Young Life. It's a Christian group that works and provides leadership skills for people in high schools, and they have a summer camp at Princeton, B.C. This is wonderful because, you know, I believe in kids, I love kids, and I love summer camp experience, and I think that it's just a wonderful fit. I'm really enjoying doing that. And I'm also a professional speaker now, signed on with the National Speakers Bureau and doing some work with them.
I see. Well, Deborah Gray, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with this book. I found it, as I said, refreshing and interesting, and for that period of time, you do a good job in encapsulating that and setting that down, I guess, that's your record of history.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Those are very kind words and not faint praise, that's for sure. And I hope people can get inspired by it. This is not just a political rant. This is my entire life and my politics. For people to be encouraged and say, wow, you know, this is not somebody who grew up in privilege. This is not somebody who's, you know, really special or a silver spoon in their mouth. Not at all. This is just a regular old Canadian who, because I believed in something and want to cheer people on, that you too can do it. Never retreat, never explain, never apologize. Just get the thing done and let them howl.
I've enjoyed talking to you today, and thanks so much again for joining us.
Thank you.
The book is called Never Retreat, Never Explain, Never Apologize, My Life, My Politics, $29.95 from Key Porter Books. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plunnett.